Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 20th of August 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. This is episode number 10 and I'm joined once again by my co-host, the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Patriarch, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. I'm currently on holiday, actually, but always good to take time out and touch down on some patriotic history.
Is there anywhere that you can let us know where you are, or is it got to be kept secret?
Yes, Albania, actually, and it's quite an interesting country, that's for sure. Obviously, it's got a lot of historical history itself, and currently it's, well, they actually refer to themselves as not belonging to officially to any religion, but it's got its cultural ties predominantly in Islam, I think, and obviously it's linked to ancient Greece and Rome. So yeah, it's an interesting history here.
Any ruins? Any interesting ruins that you can go and look at?
To be honest, there are some. Did go to a museum quite locally. And, you know, it's mostly Greek and Roman. There was an earthquake recently, apparently, so there was two floors which we couldn't actually see. So it was mostly the Roman and Greek remnants there and, all of that history, mostly kind of ancient pillars and sculptures and pottery and whatnot. But, they all kind of depict the ancient Greeks and whatnot. So, yeah, it's interesting. And obviously looking at the ancient Greeks there, they're very European. It's just like looking at a European of today, really.
And you were saying before you went, you had a look at some lead mines or something, was it? Or copper mines you were looking at?
That was where was that? Matlock Bath in the Peak District. Yeah, that was another venture that I went to with the wife, and that was interesting. But that was a lot later on in history, in terms of British history and mining. That was probably started about the 10th century AD when their technology was a bit more advanced, because they had to use a lot of, the way they ground down and drilled down into the ground, they had to go a lot further for a start. And they needed some real hard kind of metals in the first place in order to make the equipment from, and just more advanced tactics than I think was required or necessary for the mining of tin.
Yeah, and yeah. Quite some time later as well. I mean, 2,000 years later than when they started mining for tin. It's just interesting that Britain has been known for mining all these years and we don't have a mining industry anymore. How that fitted in and connected us up to the rest of the world. But and again, well, this week we're going to be talking about the Indus Valley Civilization once again, and I guess we should probably recap with a bit from last week what we were talking about last week. We talked about L.A. Waddell's theory of civilization being spread by a civilization-bearing race and the likelihood of the Indus Valley Civilization being started out as an offshoot from the Sumerian ones. We pointed out the extreme violence that was done to the original builders of the civilization and the smashed statues of the people that actually built the statues. And we asked whether this may have been done to them by another ethnic group living within the same territory, as there is no evidence of any invaders from outside doing this to them. We also learned that somehow they forgot how to write and how to maintain the complex infrastructure they had built, including their own hydraulic systems, by the end of the civilization. And we theorise that this may have been caused by miscegenation, as the later peoples that lived there were a mix of white Persian types and black Dravidian types. And before that, the people there were closest in racial type to Europeans today, according to recent tests. So we theorised that this miscegenation could have caused a lowering in IQ, which would have resulted in them losing the ability to actually maintain that that civilization. And there may have been resentment there as well between the different ethnicities, with one ethnicity that had access to medical care and the other one that didn't. And 15% of the bodies that we found have been really smashed up and beaten up. It looks like that civilization ended in a lot of violence. And before the violence occurred, there was a lot of statues that were being smashed. And then we moved on from that to talk about the complex city planning that they had, sanitation, plumbing, textiles made from cotton, and animal husbandry, which are all pointers to it being an Aryan or agrarian white civilization. And we particularly looked at Harappa last week, and we're going to look at Mohenjo-Daro a bit today. Is there anything else that you want to add to that?
The only thing I'd like to check on is the science-based studies that actually link us back to, the peoples there. You know, just as kind of hard proof, I always like to kind of keep hard proofs or just research things like that myself, just in case anyone tries to refute the link, that's all. Because I know, like, a lot of the genetics, the R1B, I think, is one of the main genetic markers for Europeans, isn't it? So I'm assuming something like that was found there with those, you know, older skeletal remains or something.
Yeah, I got the DNA studies from Wikipedia, so it will be somewhere on the Wikipedia pages to do with the Harappan civilization. Most of the information that I'm using here, well, it all comes from Wikipedia and from National Geographic, the notes that I'm using for this one. Well, by far the most exquisite and obscure artifacts unearthed to date are the small square soapstone seals engraved with human or animal motifs that Waddell claimed were representations of similar Sumerian ones. And last week I said that they were like cylinders, because the Sumerian ones were cylinders that they would roll out into the clay. And I was wrong in that. These ones are quite different. They're small square ones. And they would actually use these for stamping down on cloth, on textiles, or on paper. And a large number of these seals have been found at sites such as Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa. Many bear pictographic inscriptions, generally thought to be a form of writing or script. Despite the efforts of philologists from all parts of the world, and despite the use of modern cryptographic analysis, the signs remain officially undeciphered. But of course, L.A. Waddell claimed that he had actually deciphered them. It is also unknown if they reflect Proto-Dravidian, who are the dark-skinned aborigines there, or other non-Vedic or non-Aryan languages. The ascribing of Indus Valley civilization iconography and epigraphy to historically known cultures is extremely problematic, in part due to the rather tenuous archaeological evidence for such claims, as well as the projection of modern South Asian political concerns onto the archaeological record of the area. This is especially evident in the radically varying interpretations of Harappan material culture, as seen from both Pakistan and India-based scholars, because, of course, they had to split all these artifacts up between Pakistan and India, and they like to claim that it was their ancestors that actually did this, even though there is no evidence for that, because when you have civilization, you expect to see it evolve, basically, and there's no signs of civilization evolving here. It just suddenly appeared with all the technology that they had in the Fertile Crescent. So the theory is people from the Fertile Crescent colonized this area. As we said last week, they came out along the Persian Gulf into the Arabian Sea. And then on the left there, you've got Pakistan, you know, you've got Afghanistan just up above that. And what we're talking about here is like the Pakistan, Afghanistan, India area. And the Dravidians that were there, they didn't have the ability to make tin. They didn't have the ability to use a potter's wheel. They didn't have any of these abilities, sanitation, sewage, all these things. And we can see that they still have problems there today with those particular instances, sanitation and sewage. But these inscriptions are very interesting, because Waddell said that they were basically showing the same animals that you have in the Sumerian seals. And also he said that they were talking about the same deities and the same people, and he tied it in that they were these original kings, and he called them Sumer Aryan, meaning that they were the white type that was at Sumer, because there were various different ethnic types there. And he said it was the same kings that were the original kings of Sumer that were honored in this place here in the Harappan civilization. And at the time, there were others that said, well, this is correct. And they've tried to come out with other explanations, and nobody's managed to come out with another explanation. He's the only academic that's actually managed to translate these. So it makes sense to me that's what it would be.
Yeah. Yeah, I just wonder why he's the only one that's managed to translate them. You know, because normally if you get multiple people being able to translate, then they can at least try and come to a compromise, or either confirm something, or, you know, prove one's not quite accurate here or whatnot.
Well, there's different ways of doing it, because they can look at an image and they can think, well, that's a pictogram, and it represents a syllable, or it represents what the picture is actually of, or it could represent the letter of a word. So you've got three different ways that you can interpret it there. And he interpreted it in one particular way and said, look, this is the Sumerian language, and it's just slightly different. And if you look at it, it's very similar to the sort of runes that we see with the Nordic types later on. And we know that Paleo-Hebrew was also runic. This is one of the earliest languages as well. Remember, it was the Sumerians that were the first to actually write stuff down in the cuneiform script. And this is like a strange version of it. I mean, people have to do the research themselves and look into this. I mean, the guy's name is L.A. Waddell. It's worth looking at his work. I've got a good biography of him and some of his books. And moving on from that, if we actually look at Mohenjo-Daro itself, a well-planned street grid and an elaborate drainage system hint that the occupants of the city of Mohenjo-Daro were skilled urban planners with a reverence for the control of water. But just who occupied the ancient city in modern-day Pakistan during the 3rd millennium BC remains a puzzle. And of course, I don't think it's a puzzle. I think it's quite clear that it's Sumerian colonists. The city lacks ostentatious palaces, temples, or monuments, and there's no obvious central seat of government or any evidence of a king or a queen. Modesty, order, and cleanliness were apparently highly valued, and products made from pottery and tools of copper and stone were standardized, as were the seals and weights, which suggest a system of tightly controlled trade. And if people looked at the image that we used for last week's podcast, you can see that they're actually using pressed bricks as well to actually build with. And that each house had its own bath. They had a great big central bath that they could all bathe in as well. The whole civilization was built around water. They had running water in their homes. They had sanitation, which would take the waste out into gullies that were outside in the road, and the gullies would take the waste down into the river. I mean, very, very advanced for 4,500 years ago. The city's wealth and stature is evident in artifacts made with ivory, lapis lazuli, carnelian, and gold beads, as well as the baked brick three-story city structures themselves. Imagine that. They're building one story on top of the other. I mean, the house is just the same as we have today. What it reminds me of, looking at it, is the ancient dwellings that we've got in Skara Brae. Have you ever seen them?
No, I haven't actually.
Up in Scotland.
Where is this? Scotland?
Yeah, up in Scotland. The sea came back one day. There were the very high tides or a storm or whatever. And when the sea went back, it had uncovered a house, basically, with a fireplace and a kitchen, and it's thousands of years old and really well built. And they think it was probably an observatory, and people went there to observe the stars. It's called Skara Brae, and it just reminds me of that. The way that it's built, and you can see that things really haven't changed today. When white people build houses today, they still look similar. You know, they look different to the way that the Chinese build dwellings. They look different to the way that Black Africans build dwellings. You know, the different peoples of the world, they have different ways of designing their living space. And if you look at Mongolian yurts as well, I mean, that's another different way of doing it. And white people have always built these square structures, and they've always had tried to have running water in there. And but to have three-story houses back then, and we haven't advanced on that today really, until recently when we built skyscrapers.
No, I mean looking in. I mean having a look around the city. We went to the docks yesterday, and even on the way in, the city structure and the streets is it's almost third world, really, looking at it. But when you go to and see remnants of some of the old buildings, which there aren't many, to be honest, you can see the kind of the roots of many some medieval roots. And the, you know, the buildings and the walls, and they used the brick, and it does look like it's a completely different people and culture. I mean, the Albanians, they do look some, you know, majority white, although there's definitely an injection of a more kind of Arab phenotype in parts. And I just wonder, you know, how the culture changed so much to the point where the streets and the kind of a typical European city, what you'd expect in a European city, has kind of not been retained. It's interesting. Anyway, I'm just trying to understand why. I don't know if it's a cultural thing, if it's, you know, a genetic thing, like in terms of the mixings over time. I don't know, but I mean, I was going to elaborate a bit more on that a little later. It's interesting. I mean, even the roads, for example, they're so narrow. There's barely, I'm in a city called Durres, and there's no real motorways. So in terms of trade, which obviously helped the flow of wealth into the nation, it just doesn't seem like there was any forward planning. You know, so it's like, oh, how do we compensate for cars in the future? And they just kind of build as they go. And so if they was to try and, you know, build trade routes in the future, it's nigh on impossible, really, to kind of get to the level of another European nation, because they'd have to really just close down so many other streets and whatnot to get to that level. So it's almost like, once you start building your nation in a way that isn't, that can't facilitate a wealthy future, then it's almost like you're just locked and limited. And I think that's what's happened with Albania. And, you know, I just wonder if that has anything to do with the Islamic roots and the cultural roots, because you do tend to see that in some of the, you know, other Islamic nations.
Well, culture is downstream from biology, isn't it? You know, first off, you have the people, and then they build around them, and the culture grows up around them. But first off, you have the people, and I would say suggest that what that shows is a different way of doing things to this. Because what's so remarkable about this is the urban planning that they had right from the beginning. So they built the place up in the knowledge that there might be more people there, and they might need wider streets, and they might need bigger docks, and they might need more of a water supply. So that they actually thought well ahead before they first started. That's the difference. And what you've got there, if you've got Albanians, they're a slightly different ethnicity to Europeans, because of the Arabs that have been there and interbred with them. So they've now got a different way of doing things, basically. They're not doing things in the same way that Europeans have done, or white people, it's wrong to call these people that were in the Indus Valley Europeans, because in Europe we just had like mining centers and fishing settlements just along the coasts at this time. We didn't have big civilizations in Europe at this time, so it's wrong to call these people European, but they were of that same ethnicity, basically. They were of that same race. It's just that they were out there over in India at the time, and there's so much proof of that, and one of these proofs is this urban planning, and as you just brought up there, there's an example there that you can actually see all around you of this difference in the way that Europeans do, or white people do, European do urban planning is different to the way that Arabic type people do this planning. Well, a watertight pool, go on.
No, I was just going to say, for the first time, I actually didn't take for granted traffic lights, you know, just a normal road where you can just, it's just regimented, ordered, and things just flow, you know. So anyone that moves over to the West from another country, having experienced and grown up in civilization where they don't have the same standards as Western nations, then, you know, I'm even more gobsmacked why they would not be fully appreciative of having been, you know, made citizens. And, you know, it's,
it does look pretty chaotic.
I kind of,
when you look at places like India, it does look pretty chaotic when you see the road systems in places like India or Afghanistan. And, you know, some of them, sometimes they'll be driving, you don't know whether they're driving on the right or the left. They're just sort of driving wherever. They don't seem to have a regimented system. And again, that's because they're a different people. That's the reason why they do that, because they're different. They are different to us. Getting back to these notes here, a watertight pool called the Great Bath, perched on top of a mound of dirt and held in place with walls of baked brick, is the closest structure Mohenjo-Daro has to a temple. Possel, a National Geographic grandee, says that this suggests an ideology that was based on cleanliness. I mean, what do we say? Cleanliness is next to godliness. Wells were found throughout the city, and nearly every house contained a bathing area and a drainage system. So they thought it was very important to keep clean. The sheer size of the city and its provision of public buildings and facilities suggests a very high level of social organization. The city is divided into two parts, the so-called citadel and the lower city. The citadel, a mud brick mound around 12 meters high, is known to have supported public baths, a large residential structure designed to house about 5,000 citizens, and two large assembly halls. The city had a central marketplace with a large central well. Individual households or groups of households obtained their water from smaller wells. Wastewater was channeled to covered drains that lined the major streets. Some houses, presumably those of more prestigious inhabitants, include rooms that appear to have been set aside for bathing, and one building had an underground furnace known as a hypocaust, possibly for heated bathing. Most houses had inner courtyards with doors that opened onto side lanes, and some buildings had two stories. So imagine that, they had hot and cold running water as well, all that time ago. And it's
That's pretty advanced, isn't it?
Yeah, very advanced.
They were just, back then you just think they were completely so far behind us in technology, but there's not that much difference, is there, at all? No, is that going 5,000 years, is it?
Yeah, 4,500 years. I mean, we're talking roughly here about 2,500 BC is when they started doing this. And it was about 3,000 BC that things really took off in the Fertile Crescent with the Bronze Age and writing and all the technology that we discussed in the earlier episodes, that all started taking off around about 3000 BC. And then around about 2500 BC, it started taking off over here in the Indus Valley.
I mean, until maybe, say, 150 years ago, when we started getting, you know, more high-tech transport, I think things would have pretty much nearly been the same, wouldn't they? Near identical.
Yeah. We have the internet and we have the television now, but they had plays back then. You know, they had the equivalent of comics with these seals that they would roll out in the clay, which had images on them. And of course, if you've got a city like this, you have to have farmland on the outside of it, and you have to have roads to take all the produce into the city. And then in the city, you have the intellectual types, and they can develop new technology and discover new things. But of course, they have to keep being fed. So you have to have a system that understands that and pays for these people as well, so that they can study and advance the civilization and make life better for the people that are actually there. So when you're actually building this, you have to also set up farmland around the outside and ways to bring the produce in, because you can't do it all in the city. So it shows a very high level of social organization as well, and an understanding of being part of one particular nation. Because if they didn't have that understanding, they wouldn't all be working together to achieve what they wanted to achieve. And the fact that it ended in violence, I mean, I think that shows that there was another group there as well. And you had the conflict that arises when you have different ethnicities living within one living space, especially because it was the statues of the people that built the civilization that were then vandalized and destroyed. Mm-hmm. I mean, why would they be destroying statues of themselves? So it seems to me that it was the Dravidians that possibly did that. I mean, that's my theory anyway. Yeah. Now, continuing with the water system, the city was built in a relatively short period of time, with the water supply system and the wells being some of the first planned construction. So they understood how important this was. This was the first thing they did, was set the wells up. With the excavations done so far, over 700 wells are present at Mohenjo-Daro, alongside drainage and bathing systems. This number is unheard of when compared to other civilizations at the time, such as Egypt or Mesopotamia. And the quantity of wells transcribes as one well for every three houses. Due to the period in which these wells were built and used, it is likely that the circular brick well design used at this and many other Harappan sites was an invention that should be credited to the Indus civilization, as there is no existing evidence of this design from Mesopotamia or Egypt at this time, or even later. Sewage and wastewater for buildings at the site were disposed of via a centralized drainage system that ran alongside the site's streets. These drains that ran alongside the road were effective at allowing most human waste and sewage to be disposed of, as the drains most likely took the waste towards the Indus River. So they even had indoor water closets here, and we still use these circular wells today. You know, we still have circular brick wells today, and this is where they were first designed, were by the people in this Indus Valley civilization. And, you know, before they had anything similar in Egypt or Mesopotamia. We like to think of Egypt as being the most technologically advanced, and this was way ahead of them at the time. Must have been a really nice place to live, you know, very, very temperate climate. And you got the waterways there, so you could have the trade there from Sumer as well. You had docks there, and you got lots of you got hot and cold running water. Very, very civilized.
Do you know what type of stone they used to build in?
Baked brick.
Baked brick.
Whatever that is. So okay. Mud and straw.
So they look similar yeah. to.
Yeah, I mean, if you got baked bricks, then they're all going to be the same size. They're all going to be a uniform size that they were making, and you know, pretty similar to when you look at houses today that are made out of bricks and mortar. Very similar, in fact. Getting into the politics of it, the finds from Mohenjo-Daro were initially deposited in the Lahore Museum, which is in Pakistan, but later moved to the ASI headquarters at New Delhi, where a new central imperial museum was planned for the new capital of the British Raj, in which at least a selection would be displayed. It became apparent that Indian independence was approaching, but the partition of India was not anticipated until late in the process. They didn't expect that Pakistan was going to be, that India was going to be split in half between India and Pakistan. You see, and when that did happen, lots of awful things happened. There was lots of violence and lots of rapes when the British actually left. I mean, people run down the British Empire and say terrible things happened under the British Empire, but I don't think there was ever so many people killed or so many people raped as when the British left. When you had this civil war between the Indians, between the Muslims and the Hindus, basically, and they split the country in half, and half the country became Pakistan and it had Muslims in it. The other half became India and it had the Hindus in it. And then you had Kashmir, which is disputed, which is or it was majority Muslim. And now the Hindus keep trying to put more Hindus in there. And they still have problems with that to this day. So the British were actually preventing that from happening. And when we left, this awful thing happened. And this partition they weren't expecting, although they did understand that India was going to be independent from the empire. But they weren't expecting the country to be split in half. When it happened, the new Pakistani authorities requested the return of the Harappan pieces excavated on their territory, but the Indian authorities refused. Eventually, an agreement was reached whereby the finds, totaling some 12,000 objects, even though most were just shards of pottery, they were split equally between the two countries. In some cases, this was taken very literally, with some necklaces and girdles having their beads separated into two piles. In the case of the two most celebrated sculpted figures, Pakistan asked for and received the priest king, while India retained the much smaller dancing girl and also the Pashupati seal. And the Pashupati seal actually bears more than a passing resemblance to the seated shamanic image on the Gundestrup cauldron, dated in Denmark to 200 BC. So once again, like in Sumeria, the image of Gilgamesh, which we find on the purse clasp in the Sutton Hoo find that they say is Anglo-Saxon, but it might just as well have been early Brittonic. Just like that, here we have this Pashupati seal, which is very, very similar to this image that's on the Gundestrup cauldron, which is a cauldron that was found in Denmark 1,500 years later. So again, it shows this continuation. It's the same people, basically, because they have the same images that they use, the same things that are important to them.
I just wonder when the Pakistan and India being divided, was it along the lines of, strictly along the lines of religion then?
Yes. Yeah, and Hindus that were left in the Pakistan, Hindus that were left in the Muslim area were massacred, and Muslims that were left in the Hindu area were massacred.
Right,
it was awful.
So it was just like a purge until they became a distinct. Until they found peace, I guess, within the two subgroups.
Yeah, and you know, again, it's always the same problem. If you, I mean, this is pretty much the same ethnicity, but they had a different religion. And they couldn't get on within one territory. But it's the same thing when you have different ethnicities within one territory. It always ends up with civil war. It ends up with conflict.
Yeah.
It means that people aren't living in the way that nature intended them to live. So it's just not conducive for anybody. This is why, you know, we're against multiculturalism, because it's not conducive for anyone. You know, birds of a feather flock together. You don't, in nature, see different types of animals all living together in one territory. You have one group of animals in one area, another group of animals live together in another area. It's not natural to have them all living together. And I mean, even this is with the same ethnicity, but they had different religions. You imagine that. Well, breaking everything apart so that everybody has half of it. So separating the beads into two piles and the girdles, that shows that they didn't have any real understanding of what they actually had there, what the value of it was. Remember I said last week, they didn't understand the value of these old ruins because it wasn't their ancestors that built them, and they just looked like old useless ruins to them. We'll just use this as, we'll use these bricks to build our houses with. We'll break the structure up and we'll reuse it. They didn't understand the importance that it had in telling us about our history. And this is why when the British discovered things like that, they would put them in the British Museum so that they wouldn't get damaged. And that's exactly what happened here. The British didn't take them to the museum. And what happened was everything got split up into two piles. So instead of having a whole girdle or a whole necklace, you had half a necklace in pieces. Yeah.
Well, that's just pointless, isn't it? I mean, what's the point in having half a necklace?
Well,
did they see value in just the kind of the construct of the necklace? Like maybe it was made of pearls or something. So it's like that's the only value they saw in it was the material value.
Yeah.
And not necessarily the craftsmanship as a piece of art that's worthy of being passed down and marveled at, you know.
Yeah, just looking at it in a material way and thinking, oh, this has this value here and we want to split the value, so we'll split it in half, without understanding that it has that value because it's a whole piece. Its value is in what it tells us about history and everything that we can learn from it, and you want it to be as intact as possible. I mean, this priest king, which is, I think it's a national symbol of Pakistan, this priest king, and you can see from the face that it's Caucasian. He has a beard, and he was meditating. You can see that he was meditating in his eyes, but half his head is missing. So when you actually look at the shape of the face, I mean, you could think, well, that doesn't really have a white skull shape. It's a different skull shape. But the reason for that is that half the head is missing. It was obviously stuck up underneath something, and that's not actually the whole head that is there when you look at it. And it's an example of the images of these people that built civilization being vandalized. So, you know, it's quite strange to look at.
It's not the Mohenjo Dam, is it?
The Mohenjo Dam, I mean, there might be a dam there. I haven't heard of a dam, but if they had all these waterworks, there might be.
No, sorry, the Mohenjo Dam, just a name of a priest king in the Indus Valley. I'm just looking at that.
Well, that might be it. If you're looking at the image of it.
Mohenjo-daro.
Mohenjo-daro is the place, and the priest king is this bearded figure with slitted eyes where he's obviously meditating. He's quite a famous figure. He's Caucasian because you can tell that he has the beard.
Yeah, he does. He's got larger lips, though. Oh, the nose of his bridge is very straight. Yeah, the only questionable feature I would say would be the larger lips. But generally, I would say phenotype is typically European.
And you can see the same in the dancing girl as well. There's a dancing girl figure that they have, which isn't too damaged. But I mean, they're also these sort of images, they're stylized as well. And when you look at some of the images from Assyria, people could look at them and they can say, well, look at the hair there. I mean, it almost looks like dreadlocks. It doesn't look like it's Caucasian hair. And then when you look at the images of lions or animals, they give them exactly that same stylized hair. So it was just a particular style. Mm. That they actually use.
Yeah, it's the same with the in the ancient Assyrian Empire, definitely stylized.
A miniature bronze statuette of a nude female known as the Dancing Girl was celebrated by archaeologists when it was discovered in 1926. Kinoya, the archaeologist, notes about this, but of greater interest to him were a few stone sculptures of seated male figures, such as the intricately carved and coloured priest king, so called even though there is no evidence he was either a priest or a king. The sculptures were all found broken, and Kinoya says whoever came in at the very end of the Indus period clearly did not like the people who were representing themselves or their elders. But the thing is, nobody came in. Quite clearly, nobody actually came in at the end of the period. It was somebody that was already there that didn't like these representations of the elders of the civilization, and they smashed them up. And nobody is actually saying, well, hang on a minute. You know, we've got something similar going on today, haven't we? We've got all our statues that are being smashed up from within the civilization. And that's what happened here. These statues were all smashed up from within the civilization, and it ended in a very violent way. And, you know, we should be trying to avoid the mistakes of the past, not repeating them. And what some of these historians have suggested, they said, well, maybe it was a flood that happened, but there's no evidence of a flood happening either. And having a flood doesn't explain why they forgot how to maintain the hydraulics and why they forgot how to write and forgot how to use how to create new technology. It just doesn't explain that. The only thing that explains that is a lowering of the IQ through miscegenation and then forgetting how to maintain the civilization, which is what we've seen happen time and time again. But nobody seems to be prepared to offer this up as a theory for why this civilization fell. Probably because it's not a politically correct theory. But as we know, if something is politically correct, then in actual fact it's not correct because it has that modifying term before it. It says politically before it says correct.
How long did the civilization last for? I mean, there is a chance that the the technology being inherited. I mean, for example, like if we was to just reset, the West was to reset power grids off, and then you know, say 100 years after just trying to survive, try and build a computer, for example, is there a chance that that might have been the case in terms of everyone's kind of lost their trade skills in order to do the finer crafting things? It became like such a specialist type skill set, and in general the ability was lost, not necessarily through IQ, but through just perpetuating them skills and crafts.
Well, it could be, but effectively they lost the innovators. They no longer had the innovators who would have been able to work out how the hydraulic system works just from looking at it. That would have been able to work out, yeah, well, this is the way that it's supposed to work. If you just had people that were repeating what they'd been told without fully understanding what it was that they were doing, if something went wrong, they wouldn't know how to fix it. Like Chinese whispers, if you're just repeating things and you keep repeating things, eventually the words change, don't they? So it's a similar thing that's happening here, I think. Just what ended the Indus civilization and Mohenjo-Daro is a mystery, and this comes from National Geographic. Kanoya suggests that the Indus River changed course, which would have hampered the local agricultural economy and the city's importance as a centre of trade. But no evidence exists that flooding destroyed the city, and the city wasn't totally abandoned. And Pahosil says a changing river course does not explain the collapse of the entire Indus civilization. Throughout the valley, the culture changed, he says. It reached some kind of obvious archaeological fruition about 1900 BC. He said, and what caused the destruction of it? Nobody knows. You know, just nobody knows what happened to it. But the obvious, the archaeological fruition was about 1900 BC, and it was all gone. So soon after that, it collapsed in violence and chaos. I think it was 1500 BC that it actually fell apart. So it lasted for 1,000 years, and then by the time of Alexander the Great, when Alexander the Great got there, it was just all under the dust and ruins. There was no city there anymore. There was no, you know, nothing there, and it remained unknown about until the British Empire, when the great archaeologists of the British Empire started digging around in India and thinking, whoa, what have we got here? The same that they were doing in Assyria and in the Near East, and we had this great understanding that we never had before of what went on thousands of years ago, from looking at the ruins in these places and wondering what had happened to the people that had lived there. Because the people that were living there now, like the people that they discovered that were living in India, they didn't have running water. They didn't have running water. They didn't have sewage systems. They didn't have hot and cold water in their homes. They didn't have the systems that the people had that were living there 3,500, 4,000 years ago had. So it doesn't make sense that it was the same people that are there now that must have built the civilization. It can't have been. Because why haven't they built? Why didn't they build another one? Why didn't they just build another city like this somewhere? They weren't able to for some reason. And it's because they were different people.
Yeah.
You know, this idea that the people that are living there now have always lived there, and they are responsible for everything that's happened in that country. You know, it just doesn't hold up. And people do it all the time. Like they'll look at the people that are living in the Near East now, and they'll say, well, 3,000 years ago, it must have been the same people. And when they draw pictures of the Near East 3,000 years ago, they'll put non-whites in it, and they'll fill it up with non-whites. Places, things like Egypt, for instance, which now has a lot of Arabs in it. But Egypt was originally a white civilization, and it fell to multiculturalism a couple of times, and it managed to revert itself back. It managed to get itself back to being run by white people, and then it fell again. I think that happened 3 times in all. And Alexander the Great was the last one to install a white aristocracy in Egypt. When we get to that, we'll talk in depth about that. There's a prayer from somebody from about 2000 BC and he's actually talking about this and the fact that there are all these different right. peoples that are now in Egypt and all their taxes are going to pay for them, and the Egyptian people are, you know, trodden underfoot. And it's it's interesting when we get to that, because the same thing has happened again and again and again in all these civilizations. It starts off with the civilization bearing people that build it, and then the peoples on the outside see that there's something good there and they want to take part in it, and the white civilization builders who are like us, they're charitable people, they want to help. So they allow these other peoples to come in and partake of the civilization. And then a resentment builds that these other peoples don't have the same as the people that built the civilization. And then interbreeding occurs. And then you end up with these rivalries and civil wars, and people forget how to do things because they're not the same people anymore. They said the reason why Athens fell is because it was no longer full of Athenians.
Yeah, true. I think also in not necessarily just the good traits of Western kind as a downfall, but also the bad traits of those that were actually in power, you know, greed and essentially not valuing the nation as a collective of people, you know, that are part of the same whole, you know, like for example the politicians are selling out the working class essentially for their own gain, you know, for cheaper labor. And I would just wonder if some of the marks of, you know, capitalism and when a nation strives for profit alone, then I think, you know, the people that are in control will subjugate their own people in exchange for wealth and gain. You know, they don't really think, they've stopped thinking for the greater good of the nation, haven't they?
Well, it's a good point that you make there. With the empires of old, they were multicultural and they all fell apart. If you look at the Assyrian Empire and the Babylonian Empire, they had all different peoples there, and they would literally move peoples from one area to another area to divide the people that were actually in that area. And we see the same thing going on in the Soviet Union. They would transport a people from one area and drop them into another area so that the people there were divided, so that they couldn't unite and throw off the shackles of the Soviets. And when you had the Roman Empire, again, that was started by the Romans, started by white people, had all the technology and everything else. And then they allowed peoples to come in from elsewhere, and they made them into citizens. And then at the fall of the Roman Empire, you had lots of debauchery going on, and you had lots of different peoples, and you, there had been lots of interbreeding, particularly in North Africa, where you had Carthage, and you had the interbreeding that went on there. And then when the Germanic tribes went in there, and it was there, the fact that they were still that same white ethnicity, they were able to turn things around. The Germanic tribes, I forget which one, the Vandals, that's what it was. The Vandals, when they went into North Africa, they were absolutely scandalized by what they saw that was actually going on there. Because, you know, they had respect for one woman for life, and they didn't want prostitution to be going on, they didn't want homosexuality to be going on, and they were absolutely scandalized by what they saw, and what had gone on there, it had weakened the Romans, and that's why the Vandals were able to take over. And the Saxons as well, I mean, they went into Rome and they took over, and they were never able to before, and it was because the Roman Empire had become weak by multiculturalism. That's what had weakened it. You know, that's what it looks like to me. It looks like the same thing happens again and again and again. And as I pointed out before, L.A. Waddell, in his work, he thinks it's a good thing. He hasn't quite actually worked it out that it was this that caused the downfall of these empires. And he says, oh, it's a great thing. And the original empire builders, the original Aryan empire builders, they would sing songs about how they brought civilization to the aborigines, and how they stopped them from their serpent worshipping cult, and they taught them to worship one god, or worship the sun god rather than the moon god, is the way they looked at it, worshipping a male figure instead of a female figure. And once they had brought them into the civilization, they would then marry their princesses. and sing songs about this. And of course, that's what led to the downfall of the civilization. If you're going to end up interbreeding with these other peoples that weren't capable of actually building a civilization, it means your descendants are no longer going to be able to build a civilization either. But he hadn't worked that out. I mean, he was writing in about 1910 and before then, in the late 1800s, I think. So they didn't really understand genetics back then and heritage. And they thought that you could teach people how to do things and they would always then be able to do things. They hadn't quite worked it out. We did a bit on this in Rural Britannia this week about how the actual germ plasm, and there's germ plasm and there's soma cells, and what the soma cells learn during life, which is what you learn, your education, none of that can actually be passed on through the germ cells onto the next generation. If you don't actually have that ability to do something like build civilization, then you will have to continually teach each generation that follows. You have to continually teach them how to do these things instead of them just understanding how to do them and do them naturally. And clearly white people understand how to do these things naturally, because we can take the lowest members of society, we can take our criminal types, which is what we did from Britain. We took our criminal types and we dropped them in Australia, and within 100 years, they built a civilization. They built a first world civilization equal to all the other civilizations, America and the rest of it. And you think, well, that was actually built with the lowest classes. And yet, once they were put in this inhospitable, barren area, and yet they were able to bring civilization forth because it was within them to do that. Because it's always been within them. It's something that white people can do, and then we try to share it with these other peoples, and because that's the sort of people we are, we are sharing people, and it doesn't work, and it ends up causing the collapse of the civilization. And as I'm sure you know, there are lots of people that are predicting that is exactly what is happening now. We're in the end throes of civilization, and it's something that is repeated itself over and over and over again throughout our history.
Yeah, it does seem like history repeating itself.
Yeah, there's nothing new under the sun, is an old phrase that they used to say, and that really does hit home to me when we look at the sort of things that these peoples had. I mean, hot and cold running water, three-story houses, mail systems. I'm still amazed that they had a mail system. And that they would print stuff out on clay tablets, and somebody on horseback would then take it, go off to another country, and you would be able to get a message to them.
Well, I think that also shows a high ethical code as well. Really, they must have had that to have trust to send, you know, valuable information in the post to someone else for them, you know, to, you know, you're entrusting someone to send that to someone else. And I think you would have had to have some kind of, you know, intrinsic moral code within the civilization in order for that system to kind of be maintained or to keep going.
Well, they were highly moral. I mean, reading Flavius Josephus, The Antiquities of the Judeans, one of my favorite books. And when you read that, it goes into great detail about Romans, Roman culture, the way that people used to think, and the Judeans, and the morality that they had, and the sense of honor and having to do the right thing. I mean, it's incredible to contrast it with today. And just you would be so embarrassed. People would be so embarrassed that they would fall on their sword. They'd rather fall on their sword than be made into a slave. Marrying for love was just seen as marrying for lust. That's what the animals do. You know, you marry who you're told to marry. It's not the done thing to fall in love. That's very base. And that was the way they looked at things. They would be scandalized to be looking at the way people are today. And the words that you said, you know, it had to be the truth. You know, if you were to tell a lie, then, you know, that was just not the done thing. That I think the words were that the words would fall to the ground if you said something that wasn't true. And when a king made a law, it could never be undone. The same as I think basically when the kings made laws, it was looked at the same as in the Bible when God speaks the world into existence. And when a king speaks and he speaks his law, it cannot be undone. That holds for all time. And the subjects themselves wouldn't lie. It was just not the done thing.
Yeah.
And when they spoke a blessing, that blessing would happen. And when they spoke a curse, that curse would happen. And the reason why it would happen is because these people were so right living. You know, they would do penitence, you know, they would be continent. They would be penance. That's it. They would be continent. They would be celibate. They would do meditation. They would do everything right to build up their spiritual power, as it were, so that when they gave a blessing, it worked. And when they gave a curse, it worked. And if they were to have lied at any point, then that would neutralize all that spiritual power. So it was all tied in with spiritual understandings and religious understandings as well. People were God-fearing men back then. They weren't worshipping themselves. They understood their role in things, and they understood hierarchy. Rather than today, where we think that that's a bad thing and everybody's all equal. You know, you don't see equality in nature, do you? You see hierarchy. That's the natural way of things.
No, not at all. I don't think even in nature, not even no two creatures are the same. You know, one's always dominates the other, doesn't it? Different traits or abilities, whatnot, but generally, one collective will, on average, dominate the other. Or
that'd
be better.
Yeah, they coalesce around one dominant alpha male. It's always the whole tribe coalesces around one person, rather than, you know, this democratic idea. Whether you see that in chimpanzees or a pride of lions or whatever, it's always one person that everything coalesces around. And we have a system where you have the king, and the king answers to God, and then you have the families, and the head of the family is the father, and again he answers to God, and the mother answers to the father, and the children answer to the mother, and then from that you'd have the families would then answer to the lord of the area, and the lord of the area would answer to the king, and the king would answer to God, and that was your hierarchy. And of course, now they try to say, well, this is all wrong, and everybody has to be equal, and women are equal to men, and anybody can be the king, anybody can be the prime minister. And of course, when you've got anybody that is the prime minister, it's not their child that is then going to be the next prime minister. So they're going to want to make whatever they can for themselves as an individual. When you've got a king there, and the king knows it's his family that are always going to be there, he's not going to sell off part of his kingdom to try and make some money for himself, because that kingdom is always going to be his, and he can apportion.
It's all interconnected, isn't it?
Yeah, and he can apportion the resources where they need to go, and the guy right at the bottom there can always go to the king and petition the king. I mean, the king was the poor man's champion, basically. Our systems of the past were all based upon natural law, I think, and what we do today is unnatural. Just everything about the way that we live today is unnatural, and that's what happened at the end of all these civilizations. They lived in an unnatural way. Soft times breeds weak men and weak habits, and hard times breeds hard men, and it's in the hard times that the civilizations get built, and they're at their highest peak. And then when things become too easy, then the men become weak and effeminate, and bad habits creep in, and the civilization falls apart, and people become weak. And, you know, we need the strong there to look after the weak. You don't want the strong being weak. You don't want everybody being weak. You know, you're just ripe for invasion by another people then. But yeah, well, so I mean, that pretty much covers the Indus Valley civilizations. Let's have a little look here. What we're going to have a look at next. I wanted to have a look at Crete next, and Crete really isn't one that I have investigated much. Do you know much about Crete?
I know it's affiliated with Greece.
Yeah,
that's about it.
It's Crete, one of the earliest ones. Crete and the Minoan civilization. That's what we're going to be looking at next. But I think we should leave that here for today. So thank you very much for coming on today.
All right.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. we will be back next Friday. Will we be back next Friday? No, we've got the Patriotic Alternative Monthly Update next Friday. We will be back the Friday after with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.